This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The U.S. Supreme Court is temporarily preventing the U.S. House of Representatives from obtaining secret grand jury testimony from special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. The court's order keeps previously undisclosed details from the investigation of Russian interference in the 2016 election out of the hands of the Democratic lawmakers at least until early summer. The court will decide then whether to extend its hold and schedule the case for arguments in the fall. If it does, it's likely the administration will be able to put off the release of any materials until after Election Day. More than 328,000 people around the globe have now died from COVID-19, and a new milestone of approximately 5 million infections has been reached. In the United States, there are more than 93,000 deaths, while the number of infections is well above 1.5 million. U.S. officials have quietly released more reopening guidance that was created more than a month ago, but initially shelved. The guidance discusses different steps organizations can take as they try to reopen from closures aimed at stopping the coronavirus's spread. On Sunday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention placed the information in a 20-page appendix to a document previously posted on its website. There are promising signs in the race to come up with a COVID-19 vaccine and to understand if humans can be immune after recovering from infection. Two studies published on Wednesday offered the first scientific evidence that reinfection may not be possible. In one study, monkeys who were infected by researchers with the novel coronavirus and recovered did not get sick again once exposed. In the second study, 25 monkeys were given a prototype vaccine and 10 other animals were not after both groups were exposed to the coronavirus-related SARS. All of the animals not vaccinated came down with the virus, and some monkeys who were vaccinated saw some protection. This is VOA News. Recession hit Japan's exports have plunged nearly 22% in April, the country's worst drop in more than a decade as the coronavirus pandemic slammed global demand. The finance ministry said imports also fell by 7%. Export-dependent Japan is struggling to juggle the health risk of COVID-19 with the need to keep the economy going. Like many nations, Japan has asked people to work from home and maintain social distance to prevent the spread of the virus. Exports fell most dramatically to the U.S., India, Australia, South America, Russia, Iran, and Italy. The only two hospitals in California's Imperial County near the U.S.-Mexico border this week found themselves dealing with the flood of patients believed to have COVID-19. Under such strain, the hospitals are telling new patients suffering from the novel virus to look elsewhere for care. Dr. Adolph Edward is CEO of the El Centro Regional Medical Center, one of the hospitals hit with a rush of patients, and says many were coming from Mexico. In El Centro, the main city, is in Imperial County, which is about 100 miles east of San Diego. Edward said his 161-bed hospital ended up with 65 COVID-19 positive patients from Monday night's influx, while the smaller hospital nearby admitted 28. The move by the two hospitals in Imperial County comes just a week after a Reuters report revealed U.S. officials voiced concern that an outbreak in Mexico could send a wave of dual citizens over the border, putting extra strain on American hospitals. Scientists in Argentina are now producing what they call a fast and inexpensive coronavirus test, which the government there says has attracted international attention. The new test is called NeoKit COVID-19, and developers say it costs around $8 and gives results in less than 2 hours. It works by mixing a liquid solution in the sample with coloring determining the status of the patient. Violet means negative and blue is positive for COVID-19. Argentina's government says the first 10,000 tests will be produced over the next 10 days and will be used by the public health sector. A high-profile civil rights attorney says a black emergency medical worker fatally shot by police in Kentucky was executed in her home. Benjamin Crump made the comment Wednesday to the Louisville Public Safety Committee, which heard testimony about Breonna Taylor's death. Her case has drawn national attention and calls from political figures for an outside investigation. A warrant to search Taylor's home on March 13th was connected to a suspect who did not live there. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 21st. And here are some of the stories we are covering. The U.S. seeks creative solutions to prepare African nations against COVID-19 threat.
When times are tough, and they are right now, particularly with the COVID pandemic, we wanted to bolster these capacities, but also remind partners that a true friend lends a helping hand in times of crisis.
Many Kenyans are unable to pay their bills due to the coronavirus. Tanzania and Kenya agree to end border closure tit for tat. Uganda's security forces are accused of using excessive force while enforcing COVID-19 lockdown measures. An ECOWAS deadline for Guinea-Bissau's president to form a government is tomorrow, Friday. And SADC leaders discuss Islamic insurgency in Mozambique.
We as Mozambique, we reported about the situation of Mozambique. We received the solidarity. We believe that we together are going to work hard to make sure that our region is peaceful. The terrorism, you can't fight alone.
That's President Filipe Nyusi of Mozambique. And a Liberian newspaper's editor is summoned today by a Supreme Court justice after a traffic incident. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Hospitals, ambulances, ventilators, masks, and even personnel are among the hundreds of millions of dollars worth of assistance that the United States recently diverted to African nations in their fight against the coronavirus pandemic. VOA's Anita Powell spoke exclusively with Assistant Secretary of State Clark Cooper of the Bureau of Political Military Affairs about how U.S. peacekeeping operations are finding creative ways to empower African nations to fight the virus.
As the African continent girds itself for what experts say is an inevitable tide of coronavirus cases, the U.S. government is trying to find creative ways to quickly render assistance. Those include repurposing existing peacekeeping assets, like field hospitals and medical equipment, to fight the virus. Assistant Secretary of State Clark Cooper of the Bureau of Political Military Affairs.
There's medical equipment that has been applied as well as training delivered to partners like Ghana, Rwanda, Senegal, and Uganda for participation in international peacekeeping. And so what we had assessed is that, of course, when times are tough, and they are right now, particularly with the COVID pandemic, we wanted to bolster these capacities, but also remind partners like Ghana, Rwanda, Senegal, and Uganda that a true friend lends a helping hand in times of crisis. And we are proud to be the number one provider on humanitarian assistance to countries worldwide.
This is, he notes, not the first time the U.S. has diverted peacekeeping supplies to fight a viral war. In 2014, the U.S. did the same in response to West Africa's Ebola epidemic.
If one looks back at the 2014 Ebola crisis, that is where the Department of State and the Department of Defense sought to apply flexibilities on field hospitals, ambulances, and equipment, as well as training packages in places that were impacted. And that it actually did provide us a template for now, for 2020.
Additionally, the U.S. has given approximately $270 million worth of bilateral assistance to fight the virus, including more than $30 million to Nigeria, more than $26 million to the Democratic Republic of Congo, more than $23 million to Ethiopia, and nearly $22 million to South Sudan. And in South Africa, the continent's viral hotspot, the U.S. government recently donated nearly 730,000 protective masks for health workers, as well as about 1,000 ventilators. But what, we asked Clark, do these efforts have to do with keeping the peace on a continent battered by insecurity? More than you'd think, he said.
It is not in the normal space of security cooperation work. However, it is part of a broader long-term investment in each other. And so we certainly want to make sure that our partners have the capacities not only for their sovereignty and their self-defense, but they maintain their capacities as far as being a partner with us. What we're doing here does provide significant long-term dividends for us collectively. I mean, when we look at the virus, like terrorism, for example, it does not know boundaries. It does not respect geopolitical borders. The virus affects everyone. So reapplying what we can does allow for us to, again, not only maintain capacities, but also help each other in a time of extremis.
And these, he said, are nothing if not extreme times in Africa and around the globe. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
9 out of 10 Kenyans were unable to pay their April rents on time as government coronavirus measures pushed nearly half of Kenyans out of work. According to the Kenya Bureau of Statistics, about 50% of Kenyans have been locked out of meaningful economic activities since March this year, when the country recorded its first COVID-19 case. As Marie Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, the government has warned that the situation could worsen if the number of COVID-19 cases continue to rise.
Kenya has hit 1,000 mark for the COVID-19 positive cases as the economic outlook looks ugly. Joblessness, business closure, and many other financial problems are what Kenyans have to brace themselves for. In a survey conducted by the Kenya Bureau of Statistics, it shows labor market has been hit hard. Speaking during the launch of socio-economic impact of COVID-19 on households report, Treasury Cabinet Secretary Ukuri Yatani said that Kenyans should get ready for hard times ahead, as 21.5% of Kenyans were unable to pay rent in the month of April.
It's clear that the direction that has been given by the government or the employers to stay at home has actually now manifested itself here. Now we've been hit by this shock, and therefore all the parameters and the assumptions that we put in place are now going to change.
In March, the government of Kenya introduced draft measures, among them banning of passenger flights, suspension of learning institutions, a move the government hoped could prevent the spread of COVID-19. Education sector has been hit hard, as 24.6% of learners, representing at least 5 million students, have not held a book since schools were closed mid-March. However, teachers in private schools have not been paid for the months they have been out of work. The owners of schools claiming hard times. George Ombeto is a teacher at a primary school in Nairobi.
The last salary which we received was on 3rd March. That means we were being paid February salary. So kindly, we are asking government to intervene, because our bosses now, they're nowhere to be found. We have tried every means. Private school teachers are dying. But now our bosses have turned against us. They don't even want to see us, for that matter. They can't even pick our calls. We are really suffering.
A number of business owners have introduced several cost-cutting measures aimed at ensuring that businesses remain buoyant. Emmanuel Oduor works for a travel agency company, was forced to take unpaid leave, a move he says has disoriented him.
Tourism depends entirely on arrivals and departures. Being that the airport is closed means that basically everything pertaining to tourism is closed as well, as we wait for the situation to get back to normal.
According to the survey, women are the most affected by loss of jobs compared to their male counterparts. The report shows uncertainty about jobs is growing as the country registers the highest number of COVID-19 cases as per yesterday, Wednesday, raising the number to 1,029 positive cases. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Tanzanian President John Magufuli says he and Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta have agreed to end the border closure tit-for-tat due to policy differences over the coronavirus pandemic. Tanzania earlier this week banned Kenyan truck drivers from entering Tanzanian territory after Dar es Salaam accused Nairobi of undermining Tanzania's COVID-19 policies. This was an apparent retaliation to Kenya's closure of its border with Tanzania and the decision to test all Tanzanian truck drivers entering Kenyan territory for COVID-19. Neville Mina is secretary for Tanzania's Editors Forum. He says the two leaders spoke by phone on Wednesday and agreed that their transport ministers will soon meet to put in place the modalities for reopening their borders.
President Magufuli was on his way from his homestead, Chato, to Dodoma, and so he made a stop in Singida, the central region of Tanzania. This is around 600 kilometers from Dar es Salaam. When he was addressing the radio over there, he has said that he had some conversations with Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta on really what transpired in our borders between Kenya and Tanzania. So he had ordered some top leaders in Tanzania to meet with their counterparts in Kenya and to resolve what is seemed to be a conflict between the two countries.
How much impact do you think the closing of the border with Kenya has been having on the people of Tanzania, particularly those in the border area with Kenya?
This have affected the people who live around those borders. Most of Kenya traders, they trade in Tanzania, and some of the Tanzania, especially the agro farmers, they trade in Kenya. So they have been affected so much.
It appears the president of Tanzania, Magufuli, may not be taking the COVID-19 very seriously because, as you know, the president has refused to impose any lockdown. What are the people saying in Tanzania?
The president has been saying that locking down the country is not the only solution. And you can see some of the people, they have trust in their president. And taking into consideration the ways of our lives, it is hand to mouth. People must go out to work so that they can get paid or they can get money so they can meet their daily requirements.
What are they saying about the testing of Tanzanian truck drivers coming across the border into Kenya?
President Magufuli have spoke a bit on this matter. He underscored that it's not true that every driver crossing the border to Kenya is COVID-19 positive. This matter, the way I look at it, is like economic, political war, because the regional commissioner for Arusha, when he was announcing the closure of Namanga border, he cited categorically that this is a tourist war and claimed that the Kenyans has been announcing that the drivers from Tanzania tested positive to give a bad impression to the tourists who are coming to Tanzania so that maybe they can suspend their trip to Tanzania and instead they go to Kenya. What I see, there is a mistrust for both parts. That's why even Tanzania have started embarked on testing the Kenyan driver.
Neville Mina, the secretary for Tanzania's Editors Forum, he was speaking with us from the capital, Dar es Salaam. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 21st. Ugandan security forces stand accused of using excessive force and targeting political opponents while carrying out lockdown measures during the coronavirus pandemic. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
Ugandan legislator Francis Zake gets goose pimples as he recalls his alleged torture at the hands of police. Police officers raided his house on April 19 and arrested him for flouting the president's order against politicians distributing food aid during the COVID-19 lockdown. Zake says police hung him by chains inside a police truck and physically abused him.
I lost my sight completely. I could not see anything because they used two cans to spray my eyes.
Critics say Uganda's state security forces are using excessive force and in some cases targeting the government's political opponents while enforcing the coronavirus lockdown. Nicholas Opio is a human rights lawyer.
What is happening is anybody who seeks accountability, whether it being in the media, the civil society, is quickly silenced, is quickly arrested or intimidated. And so actions that lead to accountability are being pushed to this side as state agencies become more and more repressive and use acts of torture.
Uganda's Minister for Internal Affairs, Obiega Kanya, says without providing evidence that Zake's injuries were likely self-inflicted, Uganda police spokesman Fred Enanga says the allegations of torture are being investigated.
A team of medical experts before he was released on police bond from the Minister of Health were able to examine him, and we are also interested in the medical report that will come out from there. If the finding supports acts of torture, the officers who are found culpable will definitely get suspended and will get charged to court.
Meanwhile, Zake is suing the police officers involved as well as Uganda's Attorney General for infringing on his human right to dignity and freedom from torture. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
Southern African leaders met in Harare yesterday, Wednesday, to discuss the growing Islamist insurgency in northern Mozambique. The heads of state agree the violent insurgency poses a threat to the region, but they did not announce plans for action. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
At the day-long meeting in Harare, leaders of Zambia, Botswana, Zimbabwe, and Mozambique said they discussed the COVID-19 pandemic and the security situation in Southern Africa, including Lesotho. But much of the talk centered on Mozambique, where an Islamist insurgency has raged in Cabo Delgado province since 2017. Media reports say the situation has deteriorated in the past month and these insurgents have killed nearly 1,000 people and displaced tens of thousands more. Mozambique President Filipe Nyusi told reporters that he was hopeful that the continent would rally behind his administration in driving out the jihadists.
We as Mozambique, we reported about the situation of Mozambique, concretely about the armed attacks or violence attacks from outsiders using our young peoples in our region. We received the solidarity. We believe that we together are going to work hard to make sure that our region is peaceful. The terrorism you can't fight alone. This is the experience what we have.
The meeting took place under the banner of the Southern African Development Community SADC Security Committee. The meeting's final communique said the region would support the former Portuguese colony, but did not specify what form of support would take. Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa, the current chair of the security bloc, refused to confirm if his country or the region would deploy armed forces to Mozambique. He said in his opening remarks that the security situation was dire.
An attack on any member state of SADC is an attack on the rest of members of SADC.
Alexander Rusero, a former international relations and security studies lecturer at Harare Polytechnic College, says he's sure that SADC will send troops to Mozambique.
Proliferation of terrorism in Mozambique is actually a cause for concern. And one way or the other, the regional bloc has to intervene because SADC is more of a security architecture than it is a development community, which is in its name.
Unlike the West African bloc ECOWAS, SADC does not have a standing army. But individual countries have in the past deployed their armies to quell security threats in other members' countries. Zimbabwe sent troops in the Democratic Republic of Congo in 1998. South Africa sent troops to Lesotho the same year. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
The ECOWAS mandated deadline for Guinea-Bissau President Sissoko Mbalo to form a government with the opposition-controlled parliament is this Friday, but there seems to be no progress towards meeting that goal, says PAIGC President Domingo Simoes Pereira. Pereira, who also faced off against Mbalo in December's presidential election, tells Ricky Schreier that the PAIGC still does not recognize Mbalo as the rightful president, but that they are still willing to work with him in forming a government.
The commission is just a way of turning the attention of the people. The 22nd of May is approaching. Sissoko and ECOWAS are not willing to fulfill the commitment that they had assumed. Now it's time to turn people's attention to something else. So now they start talking about commission. But they all know, Sissoko knows very well, that he does not belong to any president in the constitution of Guinea-Bissau to launch the process to review the constitution. Even when ECOWAS says that it was a part of the Conakry agreement, yes, as a proposal, as a advice. So Parliament, using the parties that are represented, should be the ones to propose the way to start the process.
When was the last time Parliament was able to meet? When will they be able to meet again, given the coronavirus situation?
Whatever the time they will be able to meet, that will be the time anything can be done regarding the Constitution. Because we are not writing Constitution for a ECOWAS people or a ECOWAS member states.
And you mentioned May 22nd, which is the deadline that he was given to form a government with Parliament, which is controlled again by PAIGC. Have there been any overtures toward?
The deadline that ECOWAS fixed is approaching, so they need to turn people's attention. It does not belong to the president to make the arbitration of who has the majority.
Does it concern you at all that he has said he's not afraid to afraid, or you know, he won't hesitate to call for new elections?
Yeah, but this goes online with his principle of this anarchy and this dictatorship way he has been trying to rule the country. I mean, if you you find that the majority of the parliament is not favorable to you, you dissolve the parliament and you call for an election, expecting that the same commission that has proclaimed you as president still there, and it will fabricate new results to give you the majority at that structure. So that's the whole setup, the whole strategy behind it, you know. Like we said, we gave ECOWAS, not CISOCO, we gave ECOWAS a chance to prove that they were serious about the process. They proposed a political solution, and we believe that if they implement the whole package, we can find a compromise.
That was Domingo Simoes Pereira, president of PAIGC party in Guinea-Bissau. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Lisbon, Portugal. In Liberia, the editor and publisher of Front Page Africa newspaper says he has been summoned by Joseph Nabwe, Associate Justice of Liberia Supreme Court, to appear before the justice today, Thursday, for a conference. Editor Rodney Sear says the summons is in connection with a traffic incident on Monday this week involving he and the Associate Justice.
This follows an incident that happened on Monday, May 18th. In a place called the Vitown area. It's a four-lane traffic, and I was in the ongoing traffic going toward the Bisley Freeport District, the main center of business activities in Liberia. And the Associate Justice vehicle came over to my lane. I was going toward traffic. He came into my traffic area because most of the officials in Liberia tend to disobey the traffic laws. So he came toward me, and there was a police officer in his vehicle. They tried to run me over, and I refused to move because the law says only the president and the vice president or emergency situations are entitled to have any kind of emergency bulldozing through the traffic.
Did the Honorable Justice car sound a siren? If so, shouldn't this have indicated to you and the other motorists that there was an official vehicle coming in your way?
Sadly, James, there was no sirens in the traffic. There was no attention given to other motorists that an Associate Justice was coming toward incoming traffic. I didn't even realize it was some official because this car was just coming toward me with heavy speed. It was not until I saw the GUD full license plate that I realized it may be a judge. And so I do not know why I'm being summoned when I was in the right lane in traffic.
What do you think might happen today, Thursday, when you appear before the Honorable Justice?
Well, James, my lawyer, Counselor Tiawan Ganglo, who is also the head of the Liberian Bar Association, will appear before the Associate Justice this morning. I'm not sure what it is he wants. The summon just said that he wants to talk about the incident that happened. In my view, he's being the judge, jury, and executioner of my fate. But I know I'm in the right because I know that I was in the right lane. And this is something that's been going on for a long time. A lot of officials in government misuse the traffic laws and violate all the time. And so I feel like, you know, the advocacy I've been doing, trying to curb this kind of activity in Liberia, I think this is an opportunity for me to take it to a different level and raise the awareness.
Rodney Sear is editor and publisher of Liberia's Front Page Africa. You are speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. And that's it for this Thursday, May 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Listen to Issues in the News, where you will hear a panel of prominent Washington journalists deliberate the latest developments on the world's top stories. Join moderator Michael Williams, Washington contributor to CBS Radio, Nahal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, and Josh Glancy, Washington bureau chief for the Sunday Times, this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America. Listen to Issues in the News, where you will hear a panel of prominent Washington journalists deliberate the latest developments on the world's top stories. Join moderator Michael Williams, Washington contributor to CBS Radio, Nahal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, and Josh Glancy, Washington bureau chief for the Sunday Times, this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.